This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the police in St. Louis seem to have learned nothing from the last year of Black protests. A former Black Panther Party political prisoner is assaulted by members of the so-called New Black Panther Party in Atlanta. And a crusading Black scholar stands up for African American studies at Temple University.
But first, 1,000 Black activists, scholars, and artists have signed a petition in support of the Palestinian struggle against Israeli occupation. The petition endorses the call for boycotts, divestments, and sanctions against the apartheid Israeli regime. Kristen Davis Bailey is part of the team that gathered the signatures. Bailey notes that there is a price to be paid when Black Americans take a stand for Palestine.
I think this represents a pretty significant shift in the movement for Palestinian liberation within the United States, and particularly within our own community. Because as you said, Palestine has historically, and to a degree, still is an issue that people won't touch with a 10-foot pole. It's always been the issue that sort of divides or makes clear who in our community is actually down for liberation and who just talks the talk without actually being willing to put something on the line for it. And so I think to have so many scholars in particular signing on to this letter at this time, a year after the massacre in Gaza, represents a shift in people's attitude towards Israel's treatment of Palestinians. And beyond the scholars, I think it's really important moment to have Black activists that represent movements from the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s signing on with people who are just cutting their teeth with the uprisings in Ferguson, with protests in Baltimore, in the post-Trayvon Martin era. And so it's really significant to me to have this cross-section of Black civil society taking such a large and bold statement on Palestine.
Now, this statement doesn't just express sympathy for the plight of Palestinians and the conditions that they live in. It makes the connection between Palestinians and the Black American condition.
Definitely. And I think that's what gives the statement so much power. A lot of people in the U.S. who aren't Black, a lot of white groups in the United States that express solidarity with Palestine, might do it from a position of sympathy or a position of not fully understanding what it's like to experience some of the things that Palestinians do. And while we're not under a military occupation by an army here in the United States, Black people definitely have the experience of suffering under a regime of legal violence, apartheid, of state violence in terms of mass incarceration and police brutality, and just the everyday insidiousness of living in a society that just views your very existence as threatening or criminal. And so that's the position from which this statement is extending solidarity to Palestinians and offering to continue a conversation that's been happening between our people and our movements for decades.
And you said the A word, apartheid. Supporters of Israel bristle like a red flag has been waved in front of them when it is said that Israel is an apartheid state.
Yeah, I don't understand what the big deal with that word is. Apartheid is a crime that's defined under international law, and just about all the criteria applied to Israel's treatment of Palestinians, if not within its own borders, then definitely those living under occupation or siege in the West Bank and Gaza. And so when I say apartheid, I'm not saying, oh, this is exactly what happened in South Africa. What I'm saying is this fits the criteria that are legally defined in our international community. And this word also applies not only to South Africa, but to what we experienced here in the United States under Jim Crow. Apartheid is more of a manifestation of settler colonial projects where you have an outside population moving in to settle the land that other people are living on. And the only way to justify different treatment for the settler population and the indigenous population is to set up an entirely separate and different legal system for those two populations. And so I think it's important to note that Palestine is part of the larger history of anti-colonial movements that we've witnessed in the world, but it bears a special relationship to what we've experienced here in the United States as Black people and to what Black South Africans experienced in South Africa under the apartheid regime, and that these are very similar structural issues that have slightly different manifestations on the ground.
Virtually all of the members of the Congressional Black Caucus have been to Israel. There are regular junkets for all U.S. congresspersons to go there. And yet all of the caucus went along with a congressional resolution passed during the Israeli assault on Gaza, pledging eternal support for Israel and its, quote, right to defend itself, unquote.
Yeah, I don't have much faith in the Congressional Black Caucus being the ones to liberate us or to support the liberation of people that the United States government is oppressing. I think we should definitely be pushing these elected so-called officials at least to acknowledge or expose the contradictions in their behavior and their actions. But we worked on this statement as a demonstration that power ultimately lies with people doing organizing work and people fighting for liberation. And so we don't really need the Congressional Black Caucus to move forward in this solidarity or in our liberation work. I do want to say, though, that the Congressional Black Caucus and the African National Congress even exposed some of the challenges that I'd like to be having an international conversation with the Palestinians, in the sense that once we saw Jim Crow and once we saw apartheid in South Africa, many of the people or groups fighting for resistance then became incorporated into the larger political and economic system without really changing the structure from Jim Crow or from apartheid. And so I know South Africans have many of the same complaints of the ANC as we have here of the Congressional Black Caucus. And you can certainly say the same of the Palestinian Authority, who has abandoned its call to support the liberation of its own people. And so Palestinians, once they achieve their liberation from legal apartheid, will have to face a similar struggle as we've been waging here in the United States against our own, quote, leadership that is acting against our own interests.
Isn't it amazing that even as the elected representatives of black folks in this country, the caucus expresses its solidarity with the Israeli regime, the Palestinian people still pledge solidarity with the people of Ferguson?
Yeah. When I went to Palestine 2 years ago, I think the most common phrase I heard from people in different areas of the country, different ages, different parts of the struggle, was that we don't hate the American people, we hate the American government and its actions towards us. So unlike most Americans, the majority of Palestinians I spoke with were able to differentiate between the actions of a government and the goodwill of the people that the government is supposedly representing. That's something that I wish most people here in the United States or in the West more broadly could have a better understanding of. But yeah, it makes absolute sense that Palestinians would express solidarity with Ferguson, even in the context of all that the United States government does to it.
And what purposes will this petition be put in terms of supporting the boycotts, divestment, and sanctions against Israel movement?
I think it's a huge step for the BDS movement to have this statement, because a lot of people over the past year, as the American Studies Association and other academic institutions have supported the academic boycott of Israel, there's been a lot of pushback or flack on, okay, well, we support boycotts of settlements or divestment of companies and settlements, but we're not going to, like, the larger occupation, that's off limits, or the academic boycott, that's just taking it too far. And so to have 1,000 people, and in particular about 150 scholars, endorsing the full BDS movement, which includes the academic and cultural boycott, is a huge step. I think another important thing to note is that everyone who signs the statement is endorsing all three aspects of the calls to BDS. So not only are we calling for an end to the occupation, we're also calling for full legal equality of Palestinians living in Israel, and, as the statement mentioned, the right of return for the 7 million refugees currently living in exile. We call this the most important aspect of justice for Palestinians in the statement, precisely because it's so often left out of discussions in mainstream circles about justice for Palestinians, which tend to only focus on ending the occupation. And so in terms of BDS on the ground here in the U.S., I hope that we can start to see more organizing within our own black civic and religious spaces in terms of divestment. I hope we can see more action on the college level, both in black and predominantly white institutions, pushing for divestment. And I also hope we can start to have conversations about how some of these companies are also profiting from our own oppression here in the United States, and would like to see more organizing within our own community against exploitation of that sort.
At many demonstrations by the movement that generally goes under the heading of Black Lives Matter, we hear mention of the fact that many U.S. police departments send their personnel for training in Israel.
Yeah, that's been a huge piece of the conversation over the past, not even year. I think that we've been hearing talking about that for the past 2 or 3 years or so. And the first thing I want to make clear is that we know the United States, or police in the United States, would be oppressing Black people even if they weren't going to Israel to train with Israel's own, quote, security apparatus. But the fact that these two forces are working together demonstrates the similar types of states or the similar values and ideologies that they uphold. I think what the joint training of U.S. and Israeli police and military forces represents is the larger global apparatus of police repression and, quote, security. We know that Israel is the largest manufacturer of drones in the world. We know that Israel has sold arms to almost every counter-revolutionary movement in the world since the 1950s, most notably, or including Nicaragua, including the South African apartheid regime as late as 1987 or 88. And so a lot of people, when they hear these connections between the U.S. and Israel, between Ferguson and Palestine, don't understand this wider history of Israel working against liberation of people around the world. And so this isn't just a call that's emerging within the last few years, or this isn't just a connection we're making between Black and Palestinian people. This is a sort of global issue which explains why we see such strong solidarity from the global South towards Palestine, whether it's from Latin America, whether it's from African countries, or what have you. And so what we're looking at right now is building a global, a transnational movement to maintain the security and safety of our own communities in the face of global state repression.
And we're not talking about just Black America expressing solidarity with Palestinians. I think you're also saying that Black America has something to learn from the Palestinian struggle.
Yeah, the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions is very significant. In its name, it says these are the three tactics we're asking people of conscience around the world to use. And they also lay out the three different aims that they say will provide them with the conditions they need to fulfill self-determination. For Black Americans who have never had the ability to exercise our own right to self-determination, and who a lot of times get caught up in trying to define exactly what it is that we're seeking, Palestinians provide us a very good model for giving international supporters around the world a very clear mandate of what it looks like to support us. Now, for us, the exact actions we'd be calling for might look a little bit different. They'd probably include things like reparations for slavery and Jim Crow, abolishing the prison system, and creating zones of personal or community autonomy away from the police, things of that nature. But it would be great for our own community to present a clear request for solidarity and a clear request for change that would allow us to build the momentum that the BDS movement has built over the past 10 years towards ensuring the self-determination of Palestinians.
That was Kristen Davis Bailey of the BDS campaign.
Activists from Ferguson, Missouri, and Greater Black St. Louis called a press conference to denounce police assaults on demonstrators protesting the killing of a Black teenager last week, as well as the reopening of 1,000 misdemeanor cases against demonstrators arrested during the past year of protests against the police killing of Michael Brown. 18-year-old Mansour Bey was shot to death by St. Louis police, who claimed he pointed a gun at them. The neighborhood didn't believe the cop's story. When hundreds took to the streets, they were tear-gassed, with 9 arrested. Activists with the Organization for Black Struggle say the police are deliberately provoking the community and trashing people's constitutional rights. They were joined at the press conference by attorney Denise Lieberman of the Advancement Project and Brendan Rudiger, a professor at St. Louis University School of Law. Montague Simmons of the Organization for Black Struggle said the community is fed up with the cops and the local power structure.
With the death of Mansour Bey, what we've seen by the political officials that are actually charged with controlling policing authorities in our areas, that they pretty much doubled down on tactics that they have been using since well before last year, but in excess since August 9th of 2014. Again, they deployed aggressive militarized crowd control responses that brutalized peaceful protesters and transformed portions of our community into war zones. This is the stuff of a police state. It's not a democracy. I've said it before and I'll say it again, that St. Louis is a canary in the coal mine that is our democracy. What's happening in both St. Louis City, County, in Ferguson specifically, is not anarchy, it's not rioting, it's a commentary on the sorry state of our democracy. It demands large-scale structural action to transform, not reform, our society. And by the behaviors displayed by Steve Singer, by St. Louis City last night, they are rebuking every voice that has stood up for democracy over the course of the last year. The unfortunate truth is the behaviors that we saw after the Unite We Fight weekend left us on one hand disheartened, because it means that Steve Singer as a county executive has really just been blind and deaf to the realities that we've been facing on the ground. And no matter how many voices have come forward to give witness, to give testimony, no matter what came forward in the DOJ report, no matter what the courts have already put forward in terms of what police should do in terms of warning of a crowd, we continually see them to either defy, deny, or just act like things are still normal and they can still kill with impunity, deploy chemical weapons in communities where not only are there just peaceful protesters, but people living. The gases that were deployed last night not only hit the protesters directly, but it hit folks who were just living in their homes. And so far, no one within government, not from Steve Singer, from Francis Lay, all the way up to Jay Nixon, has actually been willing to step forward and take full responsibility for this. They don't seem to understand this. We will not go away. We have a right to live. We have a right to live in freedom, and specifically to live free from fear. That community has told us yesterday, time and time again, that the behavior displayed yesterday that killed Mansour Bey has been something consistently that they've had to deal with. This can't go unchecked. For our part, we're going to stay in the streets. No matter what they put forward, we're not going to stop. And at some point, they will have to concede to democracy. They will have to concede to our right to live.
We have two attorneys on the call who can speak to and will speak to the legal ramifications of this violent police state that the city of St. Louis and Ferguson are currently in, and can provide a little bit deeper context into what all of this actually means for the people being violated, for the people actually being intimidated. So, Denise, would you like to pick up and kind of explain to us some of the legal ramifications of what we're seeing unfold in St. Louis?
Last night, the residents and protesters in St. Louis were again barraged with tear gas, chemical agents, and a militarized response to a peaceful protest activity. This action flies in the face of a federal restraining order and subsequent settlement decree that requires police to issue dispersal orders, provide clear and unambiguous warnings for chemical agents, that requires that chemical agents may not be used solely for the purpose of squelching First Amendment activity, requires police to provide not only warnings, but an opportunity to disperse and a clear egress to do so. Clearly, none of these were followed last night, and this follows a pattern of aggressive and militarized police responses that we saw throughout the actions of the last week, indeed over the last year, that have had the effect of demonizing and criminalizing First Amendment activity that is designed to bring attention to important issues of public concern. This is antithetical to the sworn duty of police to protect and serve the communities that they serve, not to criminalize them. And we saw this in numerous examples throughout the week that not only included egregious usurping of the county executive's authority by issuing a state of emergency. We saw it in mass arrests during peaceful demonstrations. We saw it in numerous civil rights violations incurred by those who were in custody at the hands of police. And all of this is compounded by the reopening of hundreds of old cases from last year, charges that prosecuting attorney himself determined not to prosecute. All of this is designed to intimidate peaceful demonstrators from engaging in protected First Amendment activity and chill their rights of free speech. People who are arrested and subject to mistreatment have a variety of potential sources of civil rights violations claims that they may be able to raise. And we are calling on the St. Louis County Counselor's Office to promptly dismiss the spurious charges that have been brought up from last year. I'll stop there and turn it over to my colleague, Professor Roediger from St. Louis University Law School, where the clinic has been working directly with people who've been arrested.
I think we're just seeing constant escalation. I mean, first, Ferguson rejects the DOJ offer. The county follows that up with issuing these absurd charges. And then yesterday we see the city gassing black working class neighborhoods. From my perspective, it looks like they're trying to one-up each other, and it's a very dangerous game.
Thank you both for sharing. Denise, I'm going to circle back to you. Can you provide a little bit of context around the current situation with the conversation that's happening about the summons? We've seen reports of several people, what could actually be several hundred people potentially receiving these summons, even some well-known activist movement leaders and even journalists. So can you provide a little bit of additional context around that and what it means for the people receiving these summons in terms of what resources are available to them and how they should proceed if they do in fact receive a summons?
Sure. These are charges that stem from arrests up to a year ago from demonstrations, minor misdemeanor arrests for things like resisting arrest, things of that nature. People who were arrested included peaceful demonstrators as well as legal observers, journalists who were covering the activities, who are now, surprisingly, nearly a year later, receiving summonses in the mail. Some of them have very speedy court dates coming up. People are understandably confused and most certainly concerned. The legal community is working to identify attorneys who can provide legal representation for everyone who receives the summons and provide tools and resources to help people respond if they get these summonses.
This is for Mr. Simmons. You said that what's needed in St. Louis and presumably in other cities across the country are large-scale structural changes that actually transform our society. Could you describe what you're talking about?
Thank you, Glenn. I mean, on one hand, like our direct response on the ground has in part been by organizing things like people's assemblies, and because in those spaces we've seen a strict failure of democracy. And in some places like Ferguson specifically, we're looking at cases of faux democracy. So we're creating vehicles for people to actually directly express their own rights and what they want. And in some cases we've actually seen examples where the community has set up their own response in the form of like cop watches and community emergency response. But on the other hand, what we're really looking for is a real strict transformation of the way police operate in our community. Right now, they're used with impunity to arrest people, disperse crowds, and restrict democratic voice. There should be a shift, so their primary goal should primarily be to protect our First and Fourth Amendment rights, which is exactly the opposite of what they're doing. Right now, they're protecting property, they're dispersing crowds, and in too many cases, they're killing people, which means they are directly out of alignment with our value system. That's got to change. And so far, both within the police unions and within those who are actually directly elected and charged with deploying those authorities, there's been no accountable response from them. That must stop.
Montague Simmons of the Organization for Black Struggle in St. Louis.
Garuba Ben Wahad, the former Black Panther Party member and co-founder of the Black Liberation Army, who served 19 years as a political prisoner, was severely beaten earlier this month by members of the so-called New Black Panther Party. The 71-year-old Wahad and five other men were attacked by 25 to 30 people at a New Black Panther Party event at an Atlanta hotel. A video shows the mob acting on party leader Malik Zulu Shabazz's orders. Kalonji Jama Chenga of the Free the People movement was one of the men assaulted along with Daruba bin Wahad. Wahad and Chenga held a press conference, but Chenga did all the talking because Wahad's jaw was wired shut.
We wanted you to hear straight from the horse's mouth what actually took place. First and foremost, we attended the event because we knew that Malik Zulu Shabazz and the New Black Panther Party had been ran out of Charleston, South Carolina. They had been ran out of Charleston, South Carolina under the guise of being a hate group. And what had happened, there was a situation with a National Action Network in Charleston, South Carolina had put out a statement, and they denounced at a press conference, they denounced the Black Panther Party and saying that the Black Panther Party was a hate group. At that point, Daruba bin Wahad, myself and others, we asked the National Action Network to retract that statement because of the fact that the Black Panther Party no longer existed. So what happened was they acknowledged that they were speaking of the New Black Panther Party and that they didn't have anything to do with the Black Panther Party, so they issued another statement saying that they were denouncing the actions of the New Black Panther Party, and it was them who they were calling a hate group. Okay, we understood at that point, Malik Zulu Shabazz and the New Black Panther Party decided to set up an event in the Atlanta area because they wanted to regain their account credibility. We know that we built a strong coalition here in the Atlanta area with our coalition, the National Coalition to Combat Police Terrorism, with folks like co-chair Daruba bin Wahad, co-chair Cynthia McKinney, myself and a number of other different folks that have come together. We formed a coalition with members of all different types of organizations, including the local chapters of the National Action Network, including local activists, so on and so forth. So we knew that Malik Zulu Shabazz and his crew would come in to try to undermine not only that particular coalition, but also the fact that the 49th annual Black Panther commemoration would be held here in October of 2015, in which we were facilitating the Black Panther reunion along with members of the Black Panther alumni. So they knew that they had to act fast in order to throw the people off course, so on and so forth. So we wanted to go there and speak to them about that and address them publicly, because it was a public event. It wasn't a private event. They put it out there as if, you know, it was some private meeting and we came in to disrupt. And that was totally not the case. We walked into the venue. There were six of us all together, including Daruba and myself. We walked towards the front and we ended up on the side of the stage. At that point, Malik Zulu Shabazz, who is an attorney who supposedly or allegedly stepped down from chairperson, he asked, "Who was that?" At that point, Daruba replied, "You know who I am." From there, Malik Zulu Shabazz decided to say, "Wahad, we'll deal with you later on." At that point, Daruba replied that, "You know, you can deal with me now." As that took place, Malik, from the microphone, he made an announcement, "Get his ass out of here. Get his bitch ass out of here, excuse me. Get his bitch ass out of here." And at that point, we were rushed from the side. I saw coming down the aisle, there was maybe 10, 15 men coming from the side, a number of other different uniformed New Black Panther members running up on us from all sides. We were in the front, so we really didn't have anywhere to go. So at that point, I decided to make a way in between that aisle so that we can have some clearance. So at that point, I met six brothers, you know, defended myself as much as I could with that, and I was hit in the back with a chair. A banquet chair. And at that point, I continued to, I staggered over. One of the members grabbed me by my head and attempted to snap my neck like it was some type of TV or movie. I was kind of surprised because of the fact that I'm like, wow, if he would have been able to snap my neck, then I would be dead. So he actually tried to take me out. So as I'm falling, I was put inside of a chokehold. I'm being choked. Big guy falls on top of me from behind. I turn my head, and he's putting all of his strength in, and he's cussing, and there's some guys kicking and trying to stop me, and some of them yelling, kill him, kill him. So I don't even believe this because of the fact that, first and foremost, we have our, you know, our disagreements. We recognize the contradictions and all that type of stuff, but we never, our intention was not to go to this particular venue to cause harm on him. And definitely, certainly not to kill him. I mean, that's just a little bit over the top based on politics, you know. But as I'm being choked out, you know, being kicked and saying kill him, and I hear all this, and all of a sudden I realize that the way this guy's positioned on me, his weight and everything, and choking me, I couldn't escape. I end up blacking out. After a few, I don't know exactly how long I was out, but after a few, I shook it off, got up, kind of staggered, where I met one of the other brothers, threw a chair at the door to try to get it open. After a few seconds, Daruba and a couple of the other brothers were being drug out. At that point, we realized that we didn't know that his jaw was broken, but we saw that his face was swollen, his eyes was black. I was told that they held him up and attacked him, along with other brothers. One of our brothers' scalp was split open. He has six staples in the back of his head. You know, a couple of the other brothers' heads were gashed. You know, so everyone's bleeding, and we're trying to, you know, make sense of it, and at the same time, get up out of there. I should note that when we first arrived, there was two police motorcycles in front of the hotel. While this incident's going on, there's no police, there's no security, any of that type of stuff. It's just a free-for-all inside of this barroom. Of course, no one came to our aid. You know, people were, I guess, in a state of shock, or they were scared, or just in disbelief or whatever, what went on. But as we're leaving out, we're leaving it through the hotel gate. It's a gated parking situation. And all of us is in one Jeep, one truck. And we're coming out, and we see two ambulances and a fire truck, and those ambulances are putting, I guess, their guys inside of the back of the wagon. So it was just interesting that with all of this taking place, the ambulances and the fire truck just happened to be on the scene, and this was the results. There's been a number of different contradictions with the new Black Panther Party, with principled organizations as a whole. You know, but again, you know, I don't know of any organization that wanted to take them out. We're all African people, and we're supposed to be fighting for the same cause, but apparently this appears to be different. So at this stage in the game, if anybody wants to ask any questions or whatever, we're open, and you know, we can deal with them as they come.
And I was watching the New Black Panther Party's video they posted on YouTube, and you can see Daruba approach the stage, walking down the aisle that's directly in front of the stage. And I see you, Kalonji, behind Daruba, but I don't see the other four men. You said it was six of you total. I don't see the other four men who were with you. Where were they in proximity to you and Daruba and the stage?
Well, the other men were right next to us. Unfortunately, the video clip that was shown was doctored. You know, I guess they had a professional editing system, because the fact that the way it looks, it just looks like Daruba and I just went on a two-man rampage. So the film was definitely doctored. You can see how it was zoomed in, and that's why they keep rewinding it and rewinding it to cover up any particular glitches. The question should be asked of the new Black Panther Party, where's the entire video at?
Actually, lots of commenters on the video were reiterated that same question, including former members of the New Black Panther Party like Jamal Crawford, and I saw NY Oil, several people with names asked them to please post the unedited video that shows when people started throwing punches. Because one of my other questions is, in statements made by the Chief of Staff, Sean Quali, and the New Black Panther Party's national spokesperson, Nadia Shakur, I saw online that they stated that Daruba brandished a weapon, that Daruba struck a member of their organization first, and that Daruba fell and broke his jaw while the new Black Panther Party attempted to disarm him. How much of that is true?
The only thing that's true is you just asking the question and then making that statement. First of all, it's not only ridiculous, not only does it sound ridiculous, but clearly, you know, it doesn't even make sense. First they say Daruba brandished the weapon. I believe they said he had a knife. Then they said he punched him. You know, so I don't know what he did with the knife or if he removed his fist or whatever the case is. Then from there, the whole thing about Daruba fell and he broke his jaw falling. I don't know how scientifically that being possible unless he just purposely banged his jaw against something. His jaw is fractured in three different places. And as he's writing down, he never had a weapon, I'm clear on that. Anyone that knows Daruba, you know, I don't think that he would be carrying a knife to attack anyone. That doesn't even make sense.
So you mentioned that Daruba's jaw is broken in three places or fractured in three places. We spoke when I got here. It's wired shut for 4 weeks at least. You can only eat through a straw, liquids, for 2 months, you've told me. I see scrapes all over your knees, scrapes all over your head. It's obvious you were taken down to the ground, and it was a struggle, because you have sores. Your knees both are covered in sores. Kalonji has a similar sore from the that looks like your skin is scraped off when you fall.
Well, was that because they were trying to disarm you, Brother Daruba? Is that why they...
They said kill him.
He said that they basically said kill him. He never had a weapon, first and foremost. There was a cell phone that he had in his hand. Daruba was actually choked from behind, punched, kicked, and strangled as well. So I believe you were not
passed out. I almost passed out.
He almost passed out. I guess I did pass out. You almost passed out.
So you still have that cell phone in your possession?
No, cell phone is in the hand of the police right now. They've hacked his accounts. They're getting friends and family getting all kinds of crazy messages from Facebook, through his Gmail, so on and so forth.
There are people suggesting a type of tribunal when third party is involved. Are you not open to involving a third party in resolving the issues?
I see what Daruba has to say to that, because I don't have too much faith in a lot of these folks. It's a lot of liberalism in this movement, and that's part of the reason why things like this and even why the ground's even set. Daruba, coming from him as the elder, he says that he's not open to any reconciliation, and it's understandable. This man is here, he has a family. Every member of the brothers who came to that particular summit, we have families, you know what I'm saying? We have children, grandchildren, so on and so forth. So, you violated in a way that, you know, it's unbelievable. So I really can't see, like, how are we going to reconcile that? Like I stated earlier, man, you know, this quote-unquote movement is super liberal. It's all the way liberal. It's funny because of the fact that you hear different people, they say, you know, well, we don't want no bloodshed. We don't want blood spilling in the street and all that. We're not saying any of that. But we are saying that you should not approach us. Definitely shouldn't approach us because of the fact that you called for our death. You called for us to be taken out. And it is by the grace of the Creator that we're actually sitting here talking to you all.
That was Kalonji Jama Chenga speaking from Atlanta.
It's almost time for the new school term to start, but public school teacher Marilyn Zuniga won't be returning to class in Orange, New Jersey. She was fired after a third-grade student sent get-well letters to political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal when they learned that he'd become ill. Ms. Zuniga hasn't been able to line up another public school job, but she's putting her time to good use.
I plan to travel and speak in different campuses and universities about not only my case, but the broader aspect of our current education system and how it's affecting Black and brown students. So that goes everywhere from the sports medicine pipeline to how teachers are being marginalized for teaching the truth in history, and also how it all affects Black and brown students in predominantly districts that are socioeconomically deprived.
And I would assume that the experience that you underwent, the experience with the kids, not so much with the administration, will be part of the education that you've undergone yourself.
Oh, absolutely. I've learned so much from this case and from this situation, not only internally, but also externally. So, of course, it's affected me in a personal way, but it's also affected many others in a political and personal way as well. And so I think that that's really important to highlight is the fact that, you know, my case is not that unique in any way, but in fact got a lot of media attention because of its proximity to blackness. And so when we talk about why I was in fact fired, it's by no means a technical reason or a question of professionalism, but rather its proximity to blackness. So it's a black political prisoner, which we wrote the letters to, is a black district, black students. And so that in itself is something to highlight and underscore, especially in the sense that black schools are under attack, the education of black students is highly under attack, and all of those things that are topics that we need to start talking about more within the realm of education. And so that's really what I'm interested in doing next year.
Certainly the episode shows that black elementary school students have a sense of social justice, and their elders ought to as well.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Do you sense that this incident has resulted in a kind of blacklist against you?
That's a great question. I think that in a lot of ways, schools and certain districts and principals have supported me wholeheartedly. I think that it's really simple for individuals to support me and to support my work as an educator. At the same time, a lot of those individuals are attached to systems which don't agree with the work that I do. And so that's a really interesting concept to kind of touch on, because there's been a lot of principals, specifically in urban districts in my area, that have expressed that they would love to have a teacher like me in their classroom. At the same time, a lot of those districts are controlled by the state. And so when it comes to hiring practices and employment opportunities within those districts, they're extremely limited in what they can do and what kind of power they have over who they employ. And so that's really important to tackle as well.
Well, we all certainly hope that you find a district that is worthy of you.
Absolutely. I hope so, too. I by no means am going to stop trying to get into the classroom. That's definitely a priority for me, and it's something that I truly believe I need to continue to do, and that's the work that I've been called to do. And so I plan to get back in the classroom soon enough, even if it's just a year that I take a break off and really take some time to speak on my case and to share my story in order to highlight these issues within education and then get right back into the classroom.
The number of people going into teacher preparation training of various kinds is down drastically in recent years. Do you think that the more and more closed nature of the school experience might have something to do with that?
Oh, absolutely. I think that in general, the teacher profession is very much devalued in our country. But even in addition to that, there's so much deprofessionalization going on within the school systems across our country and nation right now, so much so that it's gotten to the point where teachers have no real professional role in the classroom. You know, a lot of teachers are given scripts to teach from. A lot of teachers are given their full curriculum and full lesson plans planned out for them. There's a disconnect between the role that the teacher is supposed to be playing in the classroom, right? So we're given certain material and resources, but it's our position, our profession, to play the mediator role between the students and the content and how those students will be able to grasp those contents. And so with the scripted curriculum and corporatized textbooks, and then also the high-stakes standardized testing, all of these factors play into the fact that our professionalism is stripped from us, right? And so there's so much focus on standardized tests and teaching to the common core that our skills and our abilities as teachers, how we're trained as professionals, is no longer needed in the classroom in so many ways. And so we have to push back on that because the profession of a teacher is critical in a student's life. And we need to get back to where we were in education, where the teacher plays the main role in the classroom.
So teaching to the test not only harms the student, but it diminishes the value and the caliber of teachers as a resource for society.
Absolutely. I do want to add that I just recently traveled to the Dominican Republic on a teacher national tour. And so there was a group of teachers who went on this national tour, and they were all from the U.S. And we got to explore multiple aspects of the Dominican Republic, but our focal point was education and also extreme poverty. And so it was very interesting to see the alignment between what's going on with the education system in Dominican Republic and also what's going on with our education system here in the United States. And while they're two completely different nations and function different ways, there was a lot of overlap in how their education system is panning out, specifically how it's affecting Black students, even more specifically in the Dominican Republic, Dominican students of Haitian descent. And so I think this is a really important idea to talk about, because there's a group in Dominican Republic called MUDAS, Movimiento de Mujeres Dominicanas Haitano, Women in the Movement of Dominican Haitian Descent. And they're doing incredible work that I really want to push to highlight, because they're doing Know Your Rights training, they're doing political education within our communities, and they've started a school with absolutely no state or government funding, purely based off the strength of the community and the communal efforts to keep the school running. And so they're a very powerful organization that's doing work that's very important, that is similar to the work that I do here in Newark, New Jersey, out of the organization called the Maroon Project, yet they have even less resources than we do here in Newark, New Jersey. And so that's important to highlight, because our efforts and our fight for freedom is very much so connected, and it's an international struggle that we're experiencing at the current moment.
That was educator Marilyn Zuniga in Newark, New Jersey.
Supporters of Dr. Anthony Montero rallied near Philadelphia's Temple University last week, demanding his reinstatement. Montero is a Philadelphia native and lifelong activist. He was fired with the university's complicity by Dr. Malefe Asante, who then changed the name of African American Studies to the Department of Africology. Temple University is also in turmoil because of its close ties to comedian Bill Cosby, who used to sit on the university's board of trustees. Cosby's lawyer is chairman of the board. Amid all this scandal and gentrification, Dr. Montero says nobody at Temple University is speaking up for Black people's interests.
This is why African American studies is so important. Not just to African Americans, but to humanity itself. If you don't need Du Bois, who do you need? If you don't need Jimmy Baldwin, who do you need? If you don't need Toni Morrison, if you don't need Cornel West, who do you need? If you've got a problem with the Black radical tradition, which in the history of Afro-America is the majority of Black thinkers, not what Dr. Asante represents. His position is a minority position among Black folk. This idea of an Africa that never existed and never will exist. This homophobia, this misogyny, this class elitism, this willingness to associate with any and all enemies of Black Philadelphia, and especially the poor, is not what we need. Wearing a dashiki and taking on an African name does not make you a freedom fighter. Let me just say a couple of other quick things. Everyone who said this fight is not about Dr. Montero, they're absolutely right. I wish that I did not have to stand in front of you all today, in some ways speaking on my own behalf. I would prefer to speak on behalf of other people. That's why in 1981, when Mumia was arrested, I was among the first people to join the fight for his freedom. So I don't want to be here, but I'm here because we have to take on this neoliberal bill in money. They have put profits before people. Take African American studies. How could you be indifferent to the state of African American studies, where 8 professors have left the department in a matter of 4 or 5 years? 3 women have left in the last year. 2 black women, 1 last year, 2 weeks before classes left. 2 weeks before classes began this semester, another black woman left. What does that tell you? A hostile work environment.
That's right.
A misogynist work environment. A my way or the highway work environment. The president of the university and whatever is left of the board of trustees after the Cosby debacle have to take this matter in hand. African American studies, and I want to emphasize this, is not just another discipline. It is, in the final analysis, the institutional center of the fight against white supremacy. You're not going to get it in history. You're not going to get it in sociology. And that's not to say everybody in those departments are white supremacists. But they do not proceed from an anti-white supremacist ideology and worldview. It's not built into the discipline. The only discipline that comes out of the fight against white supremacy in the university is African American studies. And although it has been weakened all over this country, still remains the best hope of the democratic anti-racist transformation of the university. You take black studies out, you back to business as usual. You back to the old slave mentality. There's a thing called the black radical tradition. Any African American with an ounce of self-respect and less than an ounce of consciousness realizes that black folk were brought to this country, have been exploited and oppressed for close to 400 years because of capitalism. Black folk are not going to be liberated through capitalism. Now that, to many people, is a revelation. But when you look at the history of our thinkers, they all had come to that conclusion. If you don't like that tradition, you don't like African American studies, because that's what African people have thought about and the way we have articulated our future and the future of this country. We are, by the very nature of our position in the society, anti-capitalists. Yeah. We're holding the university accountable. We're raising questions about the governance of this university. We said to the chairman of the board of trustees, Mr. O'Connor, and to President Theobald, in a collegial and respectful way, take the matter of my firing under your consideration. Do what is just. In a way that would make the students and the faculty and the community proud. But they chose to go the other way. Now we have a crisis. that will equal and maybe surpass the crisis of Joe Paterno, Sandusky, and Penn State University. Not just that Bill Cosby serially drugged and raped women, but when it came to his drugging and raping an employee of Temple, and when it came to a settlement between this woman and the university, there was a deposition where Cosby and his attorneys met with the young woman, the Temple employee, and her attorney. The deposition was sealed. It was unsealed about 3 months ago by a federal judge for two reasons. One, a woman in California who is bringing more than a civil case, a criminal case, claiming that when she was 15, Cosby took her to the Playboy Mansion, drugged her, and had sex with her. But the deposition revealed certain things about the leadership of Temple, and they're not very nice. Mr. O'Connor, in defending Mr. Cosby, so defamed and bullied the young woman and her attorney that they had to go into federal court to ask for relief. And the only reason a federal judge didn't rule on it is because the case, the settlement, came before the judge could rule. But that deposition exposes that Mr. O'Connor and the administration of Temple, which has paraded Mr. Cosby in front of incoming freshmen, in front of graduates and their families, as what Temple is, as what Temple graduates turn out to be, as they say, Temple made, that they had defended what we now know is a rape culture.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.